Hello and welcome to episode number 8 of Investing from the Beach. I'm Chris Hansen. I'm your host, and I've got my co-host with me today, Chris Lamb.
Hello, everyone.
And if you're new to the show, give a quick background on this. We both worked for IBM. I was there about almost 20 years, 18 plus. Chris, how long did you work at IBM? I don't even remember. Were you 10 years?
Roughly 10 years.
Roughly 10 years.
Too long.
And so the story on this is I had learned the stock market when I was at IBM. It got to the point where I was making more there than I was at IBM. I was in sales, making a nice, comfortable six-figure gig, and got to the point where I was making more, and got the point where you say, gosh, I hope they say something that annoys me, because then I will leave. And they did, and I did. And that was back in 2002. And I was about 40, almost 41 years old. And Chris did the same thing, although he's almost 20 years younger than I am, but he did it about 10 years after I did, and did it with 10 fewer years than I did. So we've had lots of people come up to both of us, both collectively and separately, saying, wow, that's amazing that you guys did it. And I think the thing that's really amazing is that some guy was able to do it when he had just barely broken 30. And that, to me, is really a testament that this stuff is possible. What we have found over the years in talking about this, and we've had many, many, many long discussions.
Before you get into that, Chris, and I kind of want to chime in so our listeners can understand, you know, kind of from my perspective, and you guys got to understand, you know, how Chris Hansen was when he was at IBM. You know, I was an intern at the time, and, you know, he seems like the most relaxed, you know, person in the office or, you know, in IBM. I mean, you know, we're in the sales team, and it's, you know, bear market, 2000, 2001. Everybody was afraid to lose their job. This guy walks around with a big smirk and, you know, just loving life. And you can tell there was a different aura in being around Chris. And most of the people that when Chris left, they weren't surprised because they knew, like, he didn't care really about, you know, any stress or anything that pressure that, you know, management would put on him. So I was inspired by that alone, and it you know, made me to realize that, you know, the corporate world wasn't the thing, right, for me.
So it's a cool thing. Unfortunately, I didn't make a killing during the dot-com boom. I didn't think it was real. So I didn't get, my bank balance didn't swell, and I also didn't get clobbered by it on the downdraft either. But nonetheless, and I appreciate the feedback on that. By the way, as we've talked over the years, what we have seen, both in our own actions and our own experience, as well as looking at lots and lots and lots of other people, as you're going down the path towards time freedom, and it doesn't matter if you're pursuing it in the stock market, in the real estate market, if you're trying to be an Amazon affiliate, if you want to be a small business owner, it doesn't matter. It really boils down to most people focus on the how to do, the mechanics, the rules, the how to, the strategies, the tactics. It's all the how to do stuff. And that really is only about 5% of what it takes. 95% of what it takes to get to time freedom is how to think. And that's the purpose of this podcast. This is part 2 of the real estate versus stocks discussion. And it really points to financial freedom versus time freedom discussion. This is a continuation of where we left off at the end of episode number 7. So we're just going to jump right in and continue the discussion that we were having from the earlier episode. I hope you enjoy. Next thing we want to talk about is growth. So what is the potential growth that I see within real estate? So the way I think about it is a couple ways that I can have growth in real estate. One is I can hope to capitalize on, you know, find a property that's undervalued. I got to drive up and down the streets and, you know, send out a bunch of watchdogs and bird dogs to find stuff for me. I find something that looks like it's undervalued, under market price. I buy it that way. I put some dollars into it and bring it back up to market value. So I've got the ability for growth there. And then if I hold on to it, really at that point, my ability for growth is going to be based on a couple of things. One is going to be based on inflation. It's going to be based on the value of the surrounding properties, which really, in my simple way of looking at this thing, is really tied more to the rental value. And so
that's tied to people's income.
You got it. It's tied exactly. It's kind of what we talked about before with the, you know, if you've got a
family, rising income,
doctor, lawyer, if you've got a family of a nurse and a mechanic. right? And so, but how much, if you look at a house in whatever neighborhood, if that neighborhood today supports, you know, people that are the mechanics and the nurses at that salary range, can that neighborhood suddenly go up in value where now everyone that's living there is making the doctor lawyer salaries? The answer is it doesn't work that way. So you really, what it boils down to is, how do you innovate in real estate? Well, you can upgrade the fixtures, but you can't change the location. And so there's only so much quote unquote innovation that you can do with a property. But
to grow the business.
To grow the business. To grow basically the rental income and ultimately the net worth of the potential asset of the real estate.
And there's very little room for growth.
Yes. But now, do I have that same issue within a public business? Like, oh my God, not at all. And you see it all the time. You could use just a simple, you know, I'll use Facebook as an example. Went public a couple of years ago with $30. Now, I mean, I don't even know what it's trying, I can't remember what it's trading at today.
But it's like $130, $140. $140,
something like that. So it's gone up 4 to 5-fold. I don't know of real estate that does that in that same short amount of time.
And you know, you can always argue the extreme, right? But that's very common in the stock market. You see that all the time.
Yes.
But, you know, a company like Facebook who, you know, bought WhatsApp, right? They bought, you know, a bunch of other social media companies. When they bring them in, they get to monetize, right? New services, new business, new offerings, and that creates growth and that drives more revenue. You can't do that in a real estate business.
Nope.
Like Chris has mentioned, you can put on all the new paints and fixtures and all that stuff, but you can't charge people a lot more than what you know the next door is charging.
If the going rent in the neighborhood's $1,000, you're not going to be able to get $10,000 for your property.
Yeah, you can make it as nice as you want, but people are only willing to pay up to a certain amount for that niceness. Correct.
And that certain amount is tied to what their income is. It's a percentage of their income.
And I mean, another good example of growth, right? For like, say, a public company was Disney. You know, you saw, you know, not just looking at the stock price, but you know, Disney as a business, when they bought Star Wars, right? They came out and, you know, did a movie and, you know, here's $3 billion in income, right? In revenue. Mm-hmm. And you know what? Star Wars will never go away. Every few years or 5 years or within at least every 10 years, I know there's going to be a Star Wars movie. There's going to be a Snow White movie. There's going to be, you know, a Superman movie, something.
Yep.
You know? And they're going to buy more and more of those characters. And you monetize from the same thing you own, right? There's no more money that Disney's really putting out.
Correct.
Right, to grab that revenue.
There's a couple stories on the Disney one. I think I've shared this one with you. One of my dearest friends from college has a kid who's about the same age as my son, maybe a few months older. And when his son was born, we went to the baby shower, or was about to be born. And you know, people are giving him gifts. Everybody gives him the onesies and the crib and the whatever other stuff. And I handed him an envelope with some cash. And there was enough in there to buy, I think it was about 20 shares of Disney. It was about $300.
Yeah, I love that story.
Yeah, and I handed it to him and I said, here's what I want you to do. Go out and buy as many shares of Disney as you can afford with this money. If you want to put some more of your money in it as well, that's totally fine. But buy the shares of Disney. It was about $14 at the time. And I said, you're going to become a big Disney customer here over the next few years, right? As your child, you know, works his way through, you know, toddlerhood and whatever, all the stuff. And he kind of looked at me and he smiled. And I didn't know if he ever did it. Well, I talked to him a couple of years ago and he said, you know, we still got those shares. We keep adding to them. And I'm looking at Disney today and it's priced at the moment just north of 110. And so those shares have gone up about 8-fold.
Mm-hmm.
And he did nothing. He didn't have to go work at Disney, right? He's, you know, he's become a customer of Disney in many ways, shapes, and forms. But it's a really neat, easy example. And if you're just a note for any of you that are listening, if you have to go to or you get to go to a baby shower, enough people are going to give your next child onesies and, you know, bottles and bibs and all that other stuff. give them something that's going to be much more meaningful years from now. I'm not saying go buy shares in Disney, but something along those lines. It's a great learning thing, and it's much, much more useful than a stack of onesies. Now, along those lines, speaking about Disney, we talk about innovation, and you talked about Star Wars. If you're Disneyland, let's say, if you want, you know, say, Chris, you're the guy in charge of Disneyland, and the CEO of Disney Corp comes in and says, hey, we need you to grow your business. And you decide, well, I can do it one of two ways. You grow profitability or grow revenue. And, you know, what is it that you want us to do? And his answer will be both. You say, okay, so in order to that, to grow revenue, I either raise the price for each ticket of everybody that comes in. So maybe I charge, rather than $100, I charge $105 or whatever the price increase is. And maybe while they're there, I'll see if I can get them to buy an extra hot dog or an extra hamburger or more cotton candy or a t-shirt or something. And if I can come up with some cutesy creative way to drive extra spend when the customer is at the park, I drive my revenue. And so I have to innovate something. And that ultimately is going to fall right through to the bottom line, which is going to increase the profitability, which will end up driving the stock price up. And so I can do that at a business. I can go to McDonald's and, you know, charge a nickel more for each burger if I wanted to. How do I do that within real estate? I don't have the ability to innovate. There's a cap on what I can do. But you've got all the creative forces of all those employees working collectively to figure out how can we drive more either revenue or profitability at your company, whether it's Disney, whether it's McDonald's, whether it's Walmart, Target, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, if you think about, you know, most businesses, they have an R&D division, right? That R&D division is to, you know, it's to develop new products or services that's something innovative for the market, right? So that you can grow the business and give them a competitive advantage. You don't have an R&D department in real estate.
No.
You know, that alone should tell you the growth is going to be limited. It's in real estate business. But in other businesses, there's a lot of innovation potential that the company can grow, you know, without that boundary.
There's that. The other thing that I always like pointing out to people is, you know, people say, well, all right, here's what I want to do. I want to buy a multifamily place, you know, for a rental. So, all right, let's use a fourplex as an example. Let's just say for numbers, the average rent or each unit rents for $1,000. And so your max rent every month is going to be, you know, four doors at $1,000 each. So it's $4,000 a month. Annualized, that's $48,000. And now if you say, well, you know, I want it to be quote unquote passive. You don't want to have to deal with it. So what you do is you hire a property manager. Well, now the property manager comes in and their job is to keep the place managed and occupied. And so now whenever there's a vacancy, your revenue just dropped for the year. And the property manager's job is to get somebody in there, not just somebody quick, but you need somebody of quality that's going to stay for a while and can actually make the rent payments. So you don't have to deal with the issues of another vacancy and the challenges of getting rid of them if they're not paying. And so that property manager is going to charge 7 to 10%, whatever they charge each month for doing that for you. That the base of income that you've got off that is capped. The most you can get is $1,000 per unit times four units. So the most you can make there is $48,000. You might be able to get a little bit more if you jack the rents a little bit, but you can only go so high. And each time you raise the rent, you risk the chance that somebody's going to say, eh, enough of this, they're going to move. And now you've got the vacancy issue of a month or 2 months or 3 months. And depending on the time of year, you know, if somebody moves out at the end of October, if you've got real estate experience, usually when you get somebody that's going to move in November, December, if they can move in quick, more often than not, that creates a problem a couple months later. People generally don't move around the holidays. So depending what time of year your vacancy occurs, it may take a lot longer to fill than you had hoped. And when there's maintenance issues, that potential pool of income is still capped at 48 grand. And so your property manager is dipping into that to get the place ready. And it's just, it's an interesting, when you really stop and think about it, and not saying property managers are bad, but their source of income is your source of income. There's only $48,000 that you guys can argue over, right? And they've got to spend some to keep it going. They've got to put some in their pocket, et cetera, et cetera. It's a, and again, not saying property managers are bad. Don't read into that. It's just that there is a limited potential revenue from that building, from that business that is available.
And that's why a lot of, you know, real estate or property owners, right, they tend to try to manage it themselves to save that money, right, to say, hey, so I can have more income.
Which goes right.
But they're not calculating the amount of work and time they put in. They just, you know, they're not including their own job.
There goes your time freedom.
Correct.
Right. So you can give it up. You can give up the, you can get to time freedom, if you will, or closer to it by having a property manager. But now your returns drop dramatically. And so you have to be able to look at both sides of it.
I mean, if we don't want to talk about growth, here's an example. You know, Chris, when I moved back from Texas, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I stayed in Arcadia. I rented in Arcadia for about 8 years. For 8 years, my rent stayed the same.
Nice.
Never increased, you know. So you think about it. The guy's not making any more money in 8 years.
He's making less money, actually, right?
Because of inflation. Because of inflation.
But he likes having you in there. The rent is paid on time every month. The place is kept beautifully, right? Model tenant, but his income doesn't drop and net his income actually drop and his income doesn't rise and net on net, his income actually probably drops.
Yeah, correct.
Just due to inflation.
And he's, you know, I'm sure maintenance goes up every year. Maintenance doesn't go down. It'll go up. Everything, you know, all prices kind of tend to go up.
Yes.
Right. But if, so if your income is not going up, then you're, then it's going down.
And your former landlord is a smart real estate guy. Somebody in real estate was, oh, they should have raised your rent every year. He's a very successful real estate investor. He understands what it takes. So it's not like you got lucky and got some guy that didn't know what was going on.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, if he were to raise the rent, then of course, you know, he's not going to get as good as a tenant in, yeah, right? You know, he's not going to get the place rented out as fast as he wanted to.
There's the risk he loses the current tenant, and you don't know what's coming in behind.
Yeah. Yep. And that's the numbers game you have to kind of figure out because, you know, you think if you do the math, you know, hey, if I raise you $100, you know, a month, right? Let's say your rent is $2,000 and I raise you $100 a month and, you know, that person decides not to stay there anymore because you're raising rent.
Yes.
They leave. It's going to cost you at least a month to maybe 2 or 3 months to get somebody else in.
Correct.
There's $4,000 to $6,000 of revenue you just lost. How many of that, you know, how many months is it going to take to make up that $100 a month, right? It's going to take you, you know, 20-something, 30-something months.
Yep.
Right? Just two to three years just to make up that loss, you know, month or two of rent.
So it all goes back to one has to understand what the potential income is from whether it's real estate, whether it's a public business, it doesn't matter. You have to be aware of all these numbers. So that's on the growth side. Let's talk about, and people don't think about this. I always get the raised eyebrows on this, like, oh, I didn't think about that. Taxes. The common thing I'll initially hear from everybody from the real estate side is, oh, do you know that I can take my, you know, property A and I can upgrade to property B? And I can do what's called a 1031 exchange, and I don't have to pay tax on the gains that I made on old property, property A. I just roll that into property B. And so that's why real estate has the big advantage, because I can defer taxes on the gains. And I hear that.
And why are they upgrading?
Because
they can't buy more of the same one.
Exactly. Their income is not good enough on the one, or they're looking to move into something that gives a better return.
Mm-hmm.
Right, there's that. But I also look at them and say, so you can avoid tax on the transfer. And you got me on that one. If I do a transfer in stock, I have to pay tax on the capital gains. So there clearly is an advantage there. However, what I've seen is whenever you go to sell old property and buy new property, it's a pretty good gauge to say it's going to cost you in the range of about 10% to make that switch. So if you sell a, you know, $100,000 place, it's going to cost you about 10 grand, plus or minus, to switch. And so you've got the fees on both sides, on the buy side, and again on the sell side. When I and but you do avoid the capital gain tax via 1031 exchange. When I sell a stock, well, I'm going to have to pay capital gains on that. And if I've held the stock for a while, so I get to pay long-term capital gains. So that ends up being a much lower number. So that's nice. But I still do get taxed on it. But my transaction cost in selling the stock is literally pennies. If you want to sell 100 shares of something, pick just about any broker you can find. They're going to charge you anywhere between $5 and $10. If you want to sell 1 million shares, it's going to cost you between $5 and $10. Your transaction cost is, to call it a rounding error is to give too much credit to it. It's nothing. I say it's not literally nothing, but it's less money than most of us have in our wallet today.
And you know, let's talk about that whole 1031 exchange. Because if we talk about you storing money, park it in a place, and what most people park it in real estate, or hey, if you're like Buffett, you just park it in, you know, these businesses in the stock market. How often do you get rid of them? Most people that I know who own real estate, they don't sell them. So that whole 1031 exchange is really, it's not really used that often unless you are a flipper or you're some type of, you don't hold properties for very long. And then now we're getting into, it's a job that you're doing versus, hey, I'm just storing dollars.
It's that, and in order, right. When you're flipping, you have to, on a 1031, you have to flip into something of greater value. So now you're exactly changing the dynamic of what it is that you know how to do.
And I think for most people is that upgrading, right, is because they have more dollars that they want to put into real estate and say, hey, I don't want to manage another unit, but I want to just keep one unit, but let's get a bigger unit.
Or one roof with more doors.
Correct. So that's what they're doing. So, you know, if I were to do that in the stock market, right, with a company like Disney or an Amazon or an IBM, one of those, I just buy more shares. So not, yeah, I wouldn't have to sell it. The only reason you sell it is when you no longer want to park your money in that business. And that's because, you know, it's either failing or it's not doing well for the foreseeable future, and you want to move it into another business. But, you know, that's why you get to diversify it, right? You have a lot more than just one company that you park your dollars in.
The other thing I love about this, Chris, is let me ask you this. If you own a, think of an apartment building down the street from where you live. Who really mm-hmm. owns that place? Who really is the owner?
The government does.
The government does. And you say, well, no, I own it because, you know, I got the mortgage, or I paid off the mortgage with the bank. Like, well, I'm not sure about that because you got to pay property tax every year. And if you don't pay the property tax, watch who suddenly owns your place. So you technically own it, but technically you don't own it.
Government yeah, it makes people it. Feel better when they say they own it, you know. But if they really think about it, to me, if I rent a place and you say it's not mine because I'm paying rent, well, you're paying rent to the government. So it's not yours if you have the title, but you're paying rent to the government to keep that title. It's just a way of them saying, hey, we own it, but we make you feel like you own it.
Now, Chris, let me ask you this. If you own 100 shares of IBM or McDonald's or Disney or, you know, ABC company, how much do they tax you for ownership? Do they send you
zero? If I had no money in my pocket, I'm not required to put any more dollars into them other than if I want to buy more.
So you go buy your 100 shares of ABC company decades mm-hmm. ago. In fact, your grandmother bought 100 shares of ABC company decades ago.
Yep.
And she passed and she handed those 100 shares on to you or whatever they've grown to become.
Mm-hmm.
How much ownership? You don't pay a dime. There's
not
no
a dime.
Tax
I mean,
on
you
ownership.
Ask your buddy who bought Disney, right? When you gave him, you know, those dollars for the kids, yep. You know, baby shower or whatever.
Yep.
Right. Ask him if he had to put any, if Disney said, hey, we need you to put more dollars in because there's taxes.
Nope. And they didn't call when they decided to go buy Star Wars. They didn't give him a phone call or send him an email and said, hey, by the way, can you throw in a couple of bucks so we can afford to go buy Star Wars?
Yeah.
They don't do that.
Nope.
Just suddenly the business that he owns now owns Star Wars also.
Yeah.
But no tax.
Yeah, they don't take your business away or your shares away because you don't pay, you know, every year.
Correct. So big difference on that.
So I think most people miss that, you know. It's, they have this pride of ownership. You know, the government has the pride of ownership. You just rent it from them.
Exactly.
And they make you feel like you have the pride, but you can feel whatever you want. But the reality is you don't own it.
It's temporarily in your name. So now with that, then the last piece to talk about is management. And we kind of alluded to it or talked around it before with real estate or property management. You can either take a hands-on or a hands-off approach. So you could become your own property manager. So you're the one that gets the phone calls from with something not being right, something needs to be fixed, or you've got to deal with, you know, if you have a vacancy, now you're the one that has to go find new tenants. And you get to basically become a business manager, if you will. And you have the choice, hands-on or hands-off.
Was that callers from Investing from the Beach?
Doesn't ring to the house phone, no, but that would be funny.
It's a live radio show, you know?
I should actually go on there. I should answer and say, hey, go listen to, you know, whoever this is calling, go listen to the podcast. You're going to hear yourself being recorded. So you can have hands-on or hands-off management with real estate. How much hands-on management do you have to do with your stock market holdings?
There's not a lot of, you know, management of it is very easy. Because you, number one, you mentioned it's truly on the eyesight of the triangle. You're hands off, right? You don't get involved in the day-to-day decisions. You don't touch the business. You're not an employee of it. You know, your dollar is truly at work, right? So to the management of it really is just to make sure that, hey, it's still the business that you want to own, right? So it's a periodic check of, you know, is the company still healthy, right? Is it still survivable for the foreseeable future? Right, those are the only really things that you look at, and then, you know, the I say the icing on the cake really is the ability to, hey, let me sell cover calls like we talked about, right? Mm-hmm. Give them a lease option to buy, take it away from you, right? Or hey, you know, when the business is coming down, cyclical or whatever it is, I get to insure it. Those are just, you know, icing on the cake tools for you to use. But if you never use them, I think you'll be fine.
Yes.
Right? Yep. So it's a perk to have that. Not hey, I have to you know, watch for opportunities to sell calls, or I have to watch for opportunities to insure. Right? Those are more just icing on the cake. As far as location wise, I can do it from anywhere in the world. Like, you know, people ask me, hey, when I am over in Vietnam or when I'm traveling somewhere, right, how do I go and, you know, check. And to me is a quick, you know, look at my cell phone, CNBC or whatever news medium you prefer. And, you know, I look at the glance at the market, everything looks as business as usual, then go about doing my thing. Right? It's a quick glance at the phone. You know, there's no terrorist attack, there's no the world is on fire. Everything looks normal. Go about your day. Do your business.
And you can do that in the middle of breakfast, lunch, or dinner, whatever the time difference works out to be when you're in Vietnam. And it takes you how many minutes to do that?
Not even a minute.
You can do it while you're in the middle of anything else. And we check our phone all the time on all kinds of meaningless stuff. You can do it the same way here.
Yep. And it's not even day-to-day check.
Not at all. Not all. You mentioned something about if you're new, if this is your first episode of listening to, Chris mentioned something about the eye side of the triangle. If you're not familiar with that, go back and listen to, I believe it's episode number 3 of the podcast where we talk about the money triangle. You can explain that in a little bit more detail. But so the management on this becomes, it's a lot more hands-on that's required in the real estate business. And either you're doing it yourself or people say, well, I'm going to hire a property manager. Say, that's terrific, but you still got to manage the property manager. And if you don't, remember that in that example I talked about earlier, you've got $48,000 of a max potential revenue that comes in. If you're not managing that and watching what that person is doing, you know, you may not like the results of how much they're spending to get stuff done. And it's just, you have to spend time to manage the managers. What I've seen a lot of too, and this is a commendable thing, you'll see people, they start off on the real estate side and they start off maybe doing a flip or maybe doing a rental, and they like it, they get good at it, and they start putting more and more into it. And next thing you know, they built themselves up a nice little empire. of real estate, maybe to the point too where they've now hired some people to work with them on the business. Maybe it's people, maybe they might be doing their own property management, so they've got an on-site or, you know, somebody within their own company, if you will, that's doing that. But what they've done is they've built themselves, you say they've built this little empire. What that really equates to, they've built themselves a business, which means they've built themselves a job. And in the, if you're owning shares of a company, you could own a real estate investment trust. If you like owning real estate, now you let those guys deal with it. And you go about your day doing what you want to do. And so you could still be in the real estate business, but it's not your time and effort that is required to make it go, or to even have to be the oversight.
Yeah, it's very easy, right? Mm-hmm. As far as, you know, growing your portfolio in the stock market, without having any more, it's the same amount of work. It's the same amount of effort that you got to put into managing it. It's very little compared to what you just talked about in real estate.
Well, and it's also, right?
You can give it to a property manager, but they don't own it. They don't care about it.
Yes.
Right. We talked about, you know, Disney, right? You own it, right? But the people working in the business actually cares more about it than you do, right? The management, you know, at Disney, the board members, right? They care about it more than you do.
I was like pointing out to it too, it's two things. One, it's not financial freedom that you're pursuing, it's time freedom. And so if you've got a real estate portfolio, you've got property managers, you know, working it for you, that's awesome. But it takes your time. That pulls you away from time freedom. And you talked earlier about the relative in Vietnam, right? What started off this whole thing is the management that's required on her part to run this very successful business. It's hands-on. It's not time freedom. It's financial freedom. And you have to wonder, I'm sure she's wondering, it's like, well, what if I hired a manager to take my spot? Will it run as well as it's running today if she's got a different, you know, somebody else is doing the management for her? And that's her concern, right? She doesn't know. And if it does,
yeah, and it goes back to that that money triangle that you mentioned earlier in the podcast, I guess the third episode, mm-hmm. That we talked about. But you know, if you, whatever business that you started or you're running, if it's not truly, you cannot turn it truly into a, you know, a business that runs on its own, then you will never have that time freedom. It doesn't matter who you hire to manage it.
Correct.
Because you end up having to manage that person because, right, if you hire that person, the person can, you know, do the entire thing, they're likely going to start their own. You know, they're not going to be working for you as an employee if they can run the whole thing. Usually that's what people get, you know, into, and they find it very challenging to be able to turn, you know, a business that they started into a true system that runs on its own so that they can have time freedom. Right. And for us, you know, we know that there's a lot of good businesses out there and it's already running on its own. Why not park the dollars there versus let's create something on our own and park the dollars in what we create?
Correct.
Right. I mean, you know, if you have that expertise or that, you know, creativity and you're able to come up with something, you know, like a Facebook or, right, Snapchat or one of those, you know, big IPOs and, you know, you generate all these dollars from it. Cool, great, right? But now, once you have that money, what are you going to do? Are you going to leave it all in your Facebook that you started? Or are you going to leave it all in, you know, that Snapchat company that you started?
Or GoPro.
Probably not.
Look at GoPro. So Facebook's done well. Snapchat, we can't tell yet. Look at GoPro. Spiked mm-hmm. up and then went cratering down.
Yep. But the guy who launched it probably made a lot of money.
Yes.
Right? And I'm sure he's not putting all his dollars into GoPro once he, you know, made that money.
You got it. So he moved it out and put it somewhere else. Just a comment for you on something you said earlier that it struck a memory for me. We have a mutual acquaintance, and Chris, I don't remember if you were at lunch with me this day or not, but when his parents immigrated from Southeast Asia, I think it was Korea. And I was asking him a story. So how did you come to this country? Tell me the story. And he said, well, my dad moved here, whatever it was. I said, when your dad, and I said, what business is he in? He said, well, now he's in an auto parts business. I said, oh, interesting. How did he get into that? And he looked at me and he stared at me for a minute and he started to smile. He said, you don't understand the immigrant population. And I was like, I don't know what you mean by that. And he said, if you ask anybody that was an immigrant and now they're small business owners, it was very common to see. You ask them, how did they get into that business? The business that they get into is whatever the guy is doing that picks them up at the airport. And so if the guy that picks them up, if the guy that picks him up at the airport owns a restaurant, he goes and helps him out in the restaurant. And then suddenly he says, hey, I can do this. And he'll goes and opens up his own restaurant. And this guy's story was that the guy who picked them up owned an auto parts store. And so his father went and worked in the auto parts store and eventually went and started his own. And he said, our choice of business is really determined by what the guy is doing that picks us up at the airport.
You know, what's funny is that I a friend or somebody I knew made a comment one time. He said, you know, be careful. These guys are all small business owners. Uh-huh. He said, be careful when you get an Asian guy, you know, looking for a minimum wage job in your, you know, business.
Because he's going to learn it and compete with you.
He's going to end up opening up and, learn your business and compete your business. You know.
And for those of you that are listening, this is not a racial ding. It's just, it's been our experience on where we live. This is what you see.
Yep.
And the guy that made the comment is not the white guy. So don't be throwing crap at us on an email. So, anything else we need to cover?
Well, just to kind of wrap up the podcast here is to summarize that, you know, we want to distinguish, right, financial freedom versus time freedom. And so if you're really truly trying to go after time freedom, right, I think the stock market is wonderful. But from a financial freedom, I think you got to get to financial freedom first.
Yes.
And so it's really based on your knowledge, I believe, right? For most of us, the real estate market is still a really good area for you to go ahead and store dollars in if you have no idea what you're doing in the stock market, right? You got to go learn it. And what I found is, you know, my advice to most people still is, you know, when they say, hey, I don't know what to do with my money, right? And if they currently own real estate, I say, great, leave it there. Don't go sell it, because most people, you know, aren't very prudent with their money. And if they are not, you know, storing money in a house, they're going to go buy a car, go spend something, right? They're going to buy materials that
will
depreciate over time. So at least the home or the real estate forces them to save, and it will, you know, keep up with inflation. It produces income. So not a bad thing at all, right? This is not to say real estate is bad. Right, it's really to say, what is your knowledge and your experience level? Once you understand, right, the stock market more, you're going to likely lean towards that, and that's what we're trying to tell you is, you know, if you have an interest in the stock market, right, that's what you will find, and you got to get educated first before you start throwing all these dollars and parking your money in the stock market.
Just like you got to get educated in the real estate market. Don't just go out and buy something. You have to know what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's around the how to do, that 5%, as well as the 95 of how to think. And we're trying to give you today a bigger picture on the how to think. Not doing a pro-con of real estate versus stock. It's looking at it. It's a pro-con, or it's different sides to a real estate business versus owning shares in a public business, which could be any other, you know, any other sector industry that you want to be in.
And it definitely hits on how to think, because that is the way that people think, right? As they evaluate real estate versus stock. Hmm. And if you don't think the correct way, or the 95% of how to think part, you tend to kind of do what others do.
I heard a great quote that I can't take credit for it, but man, I love the way this guy said it. And he said the biggest, and he was talking about weightlifting and, you know, doing some type of workout regimen. And he said the worst thing that a beginner does is to take the advice of another beginner. And when I read that, and he was speaking about it from weightlifting, but it applies to just about everything that any of us do. We've got a mutual friend who's a tennis pro. And I said, you know, I was talking to him the other day, I was driving, stuck in traffic. And I said, you know, it would be the equivalent of if I'm going to hire you to teach me tennis, and let's say you charge me whatever it is, $100 an hour or whatever your rate is. If I go ask a friend of mine that doesn't know anything about tennis and go, wow, what do you think? Should I do that? That's the worst person I should ask. I should ask somebody who already is a good tennis player, if that's what I'm trying to become, to say, what do you think? Because their input is much more valuable. They're not a beginner. They've got the experience that can tell me, yes, this is either the person to go to or the path to go down or the rate to pay. But a beginner has no idea. And that applies. We see it in, you know, if you're going to learn to play tennis, whether you should take it or not, we go ask beginners. If you're going to learn the stock market, people say, I'm thinking about taking the stock market class. What do you think? Well, if you ask a beginner, they're going to give you an uninformed opinion. Ask somebody who knows what they're doing, they'll give you a much better opinion. You think about taking a real estate class or a real estate seminar, whatever it might be, or should I go buy this property? You talk to somebody that has experience, you get a very different perspective than somebody that's just a beginner. And we all fall into that trap across many fields. You've got to be aware of that. So if you're a beginner, do not take the advice of a beginner.
Find it's like going to the gas station and looking for a nice piece of steak, you know?
You don't like those hot dogs from Arco? So with that, if you'd like to contact us, there's a couple ways to do it. I haven't mentioned this on earlier podcasts. One way to reach us, there is a website. It's called investingfromthebeach.com. And there's more information about us. There's a book list out there. And there's some other items out there that you may find of interest. Investingfromthebeach.com is one way. You can reach us off the contact page there, or you can send us an email, investingfromthebeach@gmail.com. Again, it's investingfromthebeach@gmail.com. Or if you'd like to leave us a message, we've had a few interesting topics that have been brought up on the voicemail. I haven't addressed them yet. We'll address those in an upcoming episode or two. That number, an easy way to remember it, no matter where you are in the world, you can jump on a 747 airplane and within 24 hours be at just about any beach in the world. And that is our number, 747-24-BEACH. That's 242-3224, I believe is the way the number works. So email, website, phone number. And the last thing I want you to think of, I'm going to play a sound clip here for just a second, and I want you to see if you can identify what that sound is. And now you've heard that, and you're going to say, oh man, that's just waves crashing on a beach. Well, the reality is, it is waves crashing on a beach, but that is not just any wave. That was recorded. I actually went down to the beach on a Tuesday near my home in Huntington Beach, California, and I recorded some waves hitting the sand. And that was actually recorded on a Tuesday. And if you go back and hit rewind on your player, you're going to notice that Tuesday wave sounds a lot different than any wave that you would hear on Saturday and Sunday that most of the other people get to hear. Our objective off doing this podcast, if you'll master the how to think, is that will get you ultimately to the point where all you hear are Tuesday waves. And let me assure you, Tuesday waves sound so much better than the weekend waves that everybody else gets to listen to. Thank you very much for listening. We love doing this, and we appreciate all the feedback that we've got. And we'll look forward to speaking to you next time.